From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. George Harrison was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week, 2 years and 3 months after his death from cancer. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with his widow, Olivia Harrison, about his life and music. She wrote liner notes for a new box set, collecting the recordings her husband made on his Dark Horse record label. Also, we meet Maren Alsop. Her first season as principal conductor of the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra in Britain garnered her the Royal Philharmonic Society Conductor's Award. Alsop is American and studied with Leonard Bernstein. Her latest CD is devoted to his music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. There are reports that Pakistani troops have surrounded Osama bin Laden's deputy near the Afghan-Pakistani border. The U.S. has posted a $25 million reward for his capture. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the U.S. is elevating its ties with Pakistan, an important ally in the fight against terrorism. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Secretary Powell praised Pakistan as a moderate, modern Muslim nation that is becoming increasingly democratic. He said the Bush administration wants to strengthen its relationship with Pakistan in strategic ways, and thus will notify the U.S. Congress of a change in the military ties between the two countries.
We'll designate Pakistan as a major non-NATO ally for purposes of our future military-to-military relations.
Only a few countries enjoy that status, and in Pakistan's case, it will make it easier for the government of President Pervez Musharraf to obtain conventional military equipment. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush thanked thousands of troops at Fort Campbell, Kentucky today, where the 101st Airborne is based. From member station WPLN, Jacqueline Fellows reports.
18,000 soldiers and families crowded a Fort Campbell parade field to hear President Bush's remarks. The president told the soldiers he appreciated their efforts, especially their role in capturing Saddam Hussein's sons.
You've added to the momentum of freedom across the world. You have helped keep America safe. You make us all proud to be Americans, and you have made me proud to be your commander-in-chief.
Staff Sergeant Rob Petrie was based in Iraq for nearly a year. He says the president's visit was important to the troops.
It shows the personal side of him to come and say, I care enough to personally come and thank you for doing what you did.
The 101st Airborne, based an hour north of Nashville, lost 60 soldiers in Iraq, the most casualties of any military division. For NPR News, I'm Jacqueline Fellows in Nashville.
Authorities in Spain have detained five more suspects in connection with a deadly train bombing in Madrid last week. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli has more on the investigation.
There's a total of about 11 people. Most of them are Moroccans. A kind of Moroccan connection seems to be emerging. And there are parallel investigations underway. They're investigating both the Madrid bombings and another judge who has been investigated for several months, the bombings in Casablanca last May that killed 45 people.
NPR's Sylvia Pajoli in Madrid. NATO is sending reinforcements to Kosovo after a second straight day of violence there. Ethnic Albanians burned Serb homes and churches, and Serbs set mosques on fire. The violence started yesterday. On Wall Street today, the Dow closed down 4 points to nearly 10,295 in active trading of nearly 1.4 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed down 14 points at 1962. This is NPR. The European Commission says settlement talks with Microsoft have failed, and it will propose adoption of a precedent-setting ruling against the company next week. Douglas Bakshin has more from Luxembourg City.
European Competition Commissioner Mario Monti said there was progress concerning past problems with Microsoft, but the sides were not able to agree on future conduct.
It is essential to have a precedent which will establish clear principles for the future conduct of a company with such a strong dominant position in the market.
A decision will be adopted next week that will require Microsoft to supply a second version of Windows without built-in audiovisual software, and there could be fines of hundreds of millions of dollars. Microsoft, in a statement, acknowledged there was no agreement on some issues, but expressed hope the case can be solved at a later stage. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Bakshin in Luxembourg City.
The Bush administration today objected to Senate legislation that would set strict deadlines for automakers to implement safety measures, including devices to keep people from being ejected from vehicles and requirements for stronger roofs. The Transportation Department says it's already pursuing some of the measures in the Senate bill. New York City's comptroller is rejecting a deal that would make Snapple the city's official beverage. Comptroller William Thompson said today he'll take the issue to court if the mayor presses ahead with it. The comptroller objected to both a deal to only allow Snapple fruit juice and water to be sold in city schools and an agreement allowing Snapple to sell iced tea and chocolate drinks in city offices. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Lumina Foundation, dedicated to expanding access and success in post-secondary education, on the web at luminafoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Harrison was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week. My guest is his widow, Olivia Harrison. They were married in 1978, shortly after the birth of their son. They met in 1974 when Olivia was working for A&M Records, which was then distributing George's record label, Dark Horse. Now all of his Dark Horse recordings from 1976 to 92 have been reissued in a new box set, which includes liner notes by Olivia Harrison. Although Dark Horse was George's place to develop his musical identity away from the Beatles, several of the songs he wrote for the Beatles, Something, Taxman, and If I Needed Someone, are included in the box set on the reissued recording of his 1991 concert in Japan. Olivia Harrison, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by asking you to choose a favorite record of yours from the new box set. I know that's probably a hard choice to make. But if you can choose a favorite, or if this helps narrow it down, if there's a song that your husband wrote about you that you could choose.
Well, there's a song he wrote about our son when he was born that I really love. And it's become a favorite once again. It's called Unknown Delight, and it's on the Gontrapo album.
Well, let's hear it.
Darkest deep brown eyes I've seen.
That's Unknown Delight, a song dedicated to George Harrison and Olivia Harrison's son, and it's one of the many tracks on the new box set, George Harrison, The Dark Horse Years. What are some of the things that he felt he could do musically on his own that he couldn't do when he was with the Beatles?
Oh, probably an enormous amount, and I think they probably all of them felt like that. But for George, he... Recently, I saw him on an interview saying that he had a quota, you know, a couple songs on each album. And he said it would have taken me about 100 Beatle albums to do the songs that he'd already written back, you know, in the 60s. Could have been an exaggeration. But, you know, they were just tremendous songwriters and a lot of material. And, you know, on his own, he was able to just really express himself.
Did that bother him that on the Beatles album... Beatles albums for him, there was a quota?
It wasn't really, I don't think it was an official quota, but, you know, I mean, really, John and Paul's,
right,
you know,
right.
But, you know, had an incredible amount of material. George, he was, you know, he began writing a little bit later, you know, everybody knows that, but he had a lot of material. He probably would have recorded more of his own songs than their albums if he did, if they'd have not been so prolific.
The new box set includes some demo recordings that weren't on the original albums when they were released. And I'd like to play one of those, and maybe that'll give us some insights into his songwriting process by hearing something before it was, you know, like produced in the studio. So this is his song, Here Comes the Moon. which I believe he wrote on a vacation in Hawaii.
That's right. That's right, actually. It was in Hana. That was a big moon rising from behind this sort of rock island. Big pink-blue sky and a big full moon rising. And he thought, you know, I don't know why I haven't written this one. You know, he really was a sun and moon man. You know, he was quite into the planets. They inspired him. And the moon inspired him.
So this is kind of his answer song to Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so this is a demo recording. George Harrison, Here Comes the Moon.
Everybody's talking up a storm. Act like they don't notice it. Here come the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Oh yeah.
That's George Harrison and his demo recording of Here Comes the Moon. It's included on the new box set, George Harrison, The Dark Horse Years. My guest is George Harrison's widow, Olivia Harrison. And that's just one of several demo recordings that he made that's included on the box set. Do you have any others you want to refer to?
You know, there was that demo of Mystical One. I don't know if you listen to that. You can hear we were in St. Bart's, I think. You can hear the rain in the background. There's kind of a funny humming in the back, and it was just pouring with rain. And I found that cassette not so long ago, and you know, it's all the whole tape's not on there, but you hear him playing a few chords, a few more chords, and then he says, "Liv, have you got a piece of paper and a pencil?" And he's literally writing it right then, and then on the cassette you'll hear him. He just plays it right through for the first time.
Why don't we actually hear that moment in which he is talking to you on that demo recording?
Great.
You got a bit of paper and a pen, maybe? Yeah, I'll have one of them. I can write on one of them, limited to... There's a wonky one on the top, on the bottom, the floor. Oh, you didn't give those ones I did to Brian.
Oh, no.
Is that one off-center?
Yeah, I want... I think it's okay.
That's George Harrison and his demo recording of his song Mystical One, and it's included on his new box set, George Harrison, The Dark Horse Years, 1976 to 1992. My guest is his widow, Olivia Harrison. You lived together in a 120-room mansion that was built in the late 1800s on 30 acres of land about an hour and a half outside London. Did that give you the sense of privacy that you wanted?
Well, first of all, I get a chance to clear up that rumor that there are 120 rooms in that house. George and I used to laugh about that because, I mean, I think Buckingham Palace might have 120 rooms, but there is nowhere near that amount. So, you know, every time we would hear that, we'd think, why do people keep saying that? So it, you know, We can just clear that up right now. It's nowhere near that.
How many were there? I
think we've got maybe sort of 6 bedrooms. You know, I'm not going to say how many rooms altogether because there's a studio and, you know, a couple of kitchens. Maybe there's 30 rooms, but there's certainly not 120. But, I certainly didn't need privacy until I, you know, met George. But he sure did. And he moved there because he'd had to move out of London, and then he moved into the country in Surrey, and then that became sort of known. And then he moved to Friar Park. And, in the end, you know, a lot of people came there too. But it was a way that he could be outside, be in a garden, and not be bothered.
How did you meet?
I worked at his record company, Dark Horse Records, in Los Angeles. And I actually, you know, talked to him before we met. And I don't know, we just got along. You know, I think we had similar spiritual ideas. I think that was the main thing, really.
In what ways were they similar?
Well, I mean, we were both into meditation and vegetarians, and you know, our priorities and goals in life were similar. And I think that was it, really.
Were you concerned when you started being together that you weren't enough the trophy wife? Well, I guess when you're that famous, you don't need a trophy wife per se, but so many famous people marry, like, the supermodel or the already famous celebrity actress. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes celebrities are matched with other celebrities, and you weren't famous. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that was the whole point.
He wanted somebody who wasn't,
you know, that was the
coming
whole
with all those trappings. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was a normal, you know, George, that's the thing. He was like this icon of our generation, and, you know, definitely and famous person, but he was a normal person who had other goals in life, you know, spiritual goals, and who had a good, you know, family life, and, you know, he'd had a lot of fun, and he'd done a lot of things, and I think that was part of the attraction, I believe.
My guest is Olivia Harrison. We'll talk more about her late husband, George Harrison, and hear more of his music from his new box set after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Olivia Harrison. She's written liner notes for a new box set that collects the recordings her late husband George Harrison made for his Dark Horse record label. Do you think that all of the fame and the money of the Beatles years in a way drove your husband to seek spirituality even more so than he might have otherwise, to find some kind of larger meaning beyond the fame and money?
You know, I found a letter that George wrote to his mother when he was, like, must have been filming Help, 69, I think it must have been. He was young. He was at the height of, you know, Beatles success. And he wrote a letter to his mother about meditation, trying to explain to her what they were doing, you know, with the Maharishi. And it's so profound, you know. He says, you know, it's only natural for people to want to find more happiness and intelligence and peace. And this is what we're doing. And maybe we can do this so that other people will be able to learn it. And then they won't have to go through all the madness that that seems to be going on today. And he's writing this, and he's in his mid-20s. And he said, when I was a kid, I knew I was going to be a success. He said, I couldn't have proved it, but it was just a feeling that I had. And now I know that I'm going to reach the real top, the highest thing that a man can attain. and all I have to do is believe in myself and keep that feeling. And he said that the highest thing that a man can attain, which is self-realization. So he'd already, he was in his mid-20s. He was at the height of success. I mean, any young man would have been forgiven for thinking that that was about as great as life can get. And yet George already at that age knew that that wasn't it, that that wasn't the highest at all. So, I mean, very early on, you know, George realized that.
I know that your husband did a lot to support the Hare Krishna movement while he was alive and in giving them a generous amount of money that he bequeathed them after his death. But was that like the only path that he himself followed during most of his life, or did he have like several different directions that he headed in with his own meditation?
Well, first of all, it's not accurate that he left a lot of money to the Hare Krishnas. So,
oh, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Correct me.
Yeah,
I already,
okay,
left, that, I already left them like $20 million or something.
Yeah, yeah. You did read that, but that wasn't actually true. You know, George wanted to support anyone that was dedicating time or helping people to have a better understanding of their purpose of life. And that included transcendental meditation, Vedantist, Self-Realization Fellowship, the Hare Krishna Movement, you know, anyone who had a desire to find out something of a more spiritual nature, George was really ready to support. I mean, not everything. He didn't tolerate kooks much, you know, but he thought that schools should teach yoga, should teach people how to live. They thought that in education they weren't teaching children things that really would help them with their internal life.
Something that surprised me, which maybe I should have known about, one of the CDs on the new box set, one of the reissued recordings, has two Hoagie Carmichael songs on it, Hong Kong Blues and Baltimore Oriole. And it made me wonder, what was the musical life like around the house when your husband was alive? What kind of records did he play around the house?
We played everything. A lot of ethnic music. I mean, when I first came to Friar Park, you know, there was a jukebox there. There were two jukeboxes. And there was everything from Christmas carols on the sitar to the Singing Postman to Hank Williams to Lead Belly, the Platters, and Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and the Goons, you know.
George from the Goon Show.
From the Goon Show. He had, like, the producers. He had, like, all sorts of things on this jukebox. It really confused me when I first arrived, I have to say.
Why did that confuse you?
Well, I mean, I'd never really heard the Goons before.
Oh,
you
I
know,
see.
Suddenly
I see.
He puts on I'm Walking Backwards for Christmas across the Irish Sea. You know, I mean, it doesn't really mean much to somebody from California. So, you know, he loved things that made him laugh, and he loved really good music. He loved... he loved Hoagie Carmichael as a songwriter, and Cab Calloway he was quite fond of, you know, or the Ink Spots, or Big Bill Brunsey and the Bulgarian Choir. He loved them. In fact, they came and performed for us once.
Well, let me play something from the new box set that is an old R&B song that that your husband covered, and it's called Got My Mind Set on You. Did he talk to you about why he liked this song so much?
Yeah, it was just a song that was always around in his head that he'd heard, you know, in the 60s. And I think because in Liverpool they used to get a lot of records, you know, it was a seaport, and there used to be a lot of records from America that came over in Brian Epstein's record store. And I guess that was one of them. And it was just something that stayed in his head, and he... Jim Keltner was over once playing a drum pattern, and one of the guys said, oh, you know, that sounds like Set on You. And he said, yeah, let's do that. It's just a song that he'd had in his head, you know, never left him.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we hear it? And this has Got My Mind Set on You, originally recorded by James Ray. This is George Harrison, one of the many tracks included on the new George Harrison box set, The Dark Horse Years, 1976 to 1992.
Got my mind set on you, but it's going got my mind set on you. I got my mind set on
you. Mr. George Harrison, one of the tracks included on his new box set, The Dark Horse Years, 1976 to 1992. My guest is his widow, Olivia Harrison. You know, we were talking before a little about spirituality, and I think, you know, religion, spirituality, whether you're following something that's organized or following something that's just more inner and self-directed, in a lot of ways, it's something that prepares you for death, because all spirituality and religion tries to find some meaning or some place in life. And that is all, in a way, about preparing you for the inevitability of your own death and for kind of accepting your place in this world, which ultimately, no matter how big, is kind of small. So I'm wondering if you think that your husband's immersion in spirituality helped prepare him for his relatively early death.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point, really. That's what you practice all your life is, you know, how high will you leap? Will you make enough for you to reap it? Only you'll arrive at your own made end with no one but yourself to be offended. It's you that decides. Those are the lyrics to Run of the Mill. I mean, you know, don't forget George wrote The Art of Dying, I know, back in 1970. So yes, I mean, of course, that was, he once said, you can't just practice at the end of your life, because, you know, you're likely to be in pain and whatever. So you have to practice all your life. You have to remember God, because whatever you remember most in your life is what you're going to think of when you're dying. And I, for one, he said, don't want to be thinking, did I put the cat out? And, you know, he really meant that. He didn't want to be having to think about, oh, dear, did I do this? Did I do that? He wanted to be ready. And that wasn't just the last part of his life. That was his, you know, from very, very early on.
Olivia Harrison will be back in the second half of the show. The new George Harrison box set is called The Dark Horse Years, 1976 to 92. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
He's fighting the forces of the darkness, limitation, falsehood, immortality, which bore him the way.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback by Eric Larson, Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair that Changed America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Olivia Harrison describes how she and her husband fought off the attacker who broke into their home and stabbed George nearly to death. Also, the conductor described as a shooting star in the firmament of international conductors. We meet Maren Alsop, the first woman ever to be named principal conductor of a major British orchestra, the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Olivia Harrison, the widow of George Harrison. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week. The induction coincides with the release of a box set that collects the recordings he made between 1976 and 92 for his own record label, Dark Horse. When we left off, we were talking about George's spiritual beliefs and his preparations for death. Well, pain can be a mighty distraction from all focused thought and all higher thought. Do you feel like he was able to hold on to the kinds of thoughts he wanted to hold on to in spite of all of the discomfort and weakness brought on not only by the cancer but probably by the treatment of the cancer, although frankly I don't really know which treatments he used?
George was pretty, you know, I think he was pretty transcendental guy. And I, you know, I don't have any doubt that he was consciously doing what he'd practiced. And I say that because, you know, and I don't really ever talk about it, but, you know, maybe it'll inspire others. But when he was attacked in 1999, you know, he was literally being murdered. And he said that at a particular point in time, he thought, that's it. You know, I'm being murdered in my own home. And he said, at that point, I thought, well, I better start remembering God because that's what you're supposed to do. And that, even though I'd known George half of my life, you know, when we talked about that, it just doubled my respect for him. Because I wasn't thinking about that. I wasn't thinking about God, really. But he was. And now, if you can do it under those circumstances, then you can do it if you're in a peaceful environment with people supporting you, helping you, if that's what your goal is. And that's what his was.
Well, I should think that your thoughts at that moment weren't about God. Your thoughts at that moment, while he was thinking about God, was, what can I do to save my husband's life, which you accomplished. I mean, you got, well, like an iron from the fireplace or something and beat the guy?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking of that. I just wasn't thinking of anything. It wasn't anything, certainly wasn't any thought. It just, you just do, you know, what you have to do. I mean, some people, I was lucky I did that. Some people might not have done it, but, you know,
I'm one of those people who always wonders, you know, people say your instincts kick in, and I always wonder, do I have any instincts like that? Would they kick in?
Believe me.
Yeah.
They're primal. It's a primal thing. You know, I don't think so. I mean, your instinct is to run away. Your instinct is to, like, I don't want to do this. Uh-huh. You know, who wants to hurt anybody? Nobody. But I think there is instinct, in the true sense of the word, is really primeval. It's not just about your conditioning. For me, anyway, it went beyond conditioning of this lifetime to some DNA primal survival thing.
And then did he, was he unconscious or did he run away?
Oh, he finally fell down.
Uh-huh. And then you called the police or the ambulance?
No, we'd already done that early on. I'd already phoned the police. But in the meantime, you know, you try and fight somebody for 8 or 10 or 12 minutes. It's a pretty long time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So were you hurt?
Yeah, I had my head cracked open.
Can I ask you something? You know, people always ask themselves, no matter how liberal their views are about, you know, the death penalty and punishment and things like that, if something happens to them or to someone they love, that would somehow be a test of what their real beliefs are. What did you wish for this man who, from what I've read, sounds like he was mentally ill?
You know, it's funny. I had no anger, you know, for him, or any feelings whatsoever, because I mean, this person just comes into your life. You have no feelings, or it isn't a grudge thing. There's just nothing. You just have no feeling. I did feel that. I mean, it was premeditated. He did come to the town some weeks before, and was looking for where George lived. I mean, he was actually trying to get Paul, but I think he just couldn't find him. So, and he was very sick, very, you know, very florid, schizophrenic. But he was deemed, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. And I think it should have been guilty but insane. And that's where I think the law, you know, could be changed, because he was treated and then got to a point where they said, well, look, now he's not a threat anymore. He's not a danger anymore. And he was released. And, well, now that he knows what he's doing, maybe then he should be punished. Because they said, you know, he didn't know what he was doing, and therefore you can't hold him and we'll treat him. And so, you know, he became sane. He became, you know, compos mentis. Now he knows. Why don't they then give him a sentence? To me, that's what doesn't seem right to me.
You are in a family that is very famous. It's something you have to live with, the fact that celebrity kind of figures into the delusional or hallucinatory life of some people who are mentally ill, and you become a figure in their delusional world, and the world of their delusions kind of enters your reality if they are prone to violence and can follow through on it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for other celebrities, but I know with the Beatles there was, you know, because people listen over and over to music, and, you know, there have been many people who said, well, you know, that song said this and it told me that. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, there are people who still write to George every day. Right. And I just think, what is wrong with these people?
Just another thing about your husband, George Harrison, when he was facing death. Tell me if this is too melodramatic or not, but it seemed like he was heading in that direction. I mean, at first it was throat cancer, then he was attacked and nearly stabbed to death, and then it was the lung cancer. And it just seemed to be like one thing after another that was threatening his life. Did it feel that way to you, that an almost inevitability that there was going to be something soon?
Well, no, there is inevitability every day from, you know, the minute we're born. And George used to say that, you know, the cause of death is birth. And, you know, it didn't actually feel like that. I mean, you know, our life became more and more meaningful and profound every single day to the end. And I think everybody should wish for a life like that.
Olivia Harrison, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Olivia Harrison wrote the liner notes for the new box set collecting her late husband's recordings from 1976 to 92 from his Dark Horse record label. Here's a song he wrote during the Beatles era, which he performs in the 1991 concert in Japan, which is included in the box set. Coming up, conductor Maren Alsop. Her latest CD features music by Leonard Bernstein, who she studied with. This is Fresh Air. In 2002, Maren Alsop became the first woman to become principal conductor of a major British orchestra. After her first season with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, she received the Conductor Award from the Royal Philharmonic Society. A review this year in the London Times described Alsop as a subtle, inspired builder of symphonic structures, the perfect guide and teacher. Alsop is American, and happily, she's still conducting American orchestras and remains the conductor of the Cabrillo Music Festival in Santa Cruz. Her first recording with the Bournemouth Symphony was recently released. It's devoted to music by Leonard Bernstein, who Alsop studied with at the Tanglewood Music Center. The CD includes his three dance episodes from On the Town, which he adapted from his score for the Broadway show On the Town, which he composed in his mid-20s. I asked Maren Alsop about studying and working with Leonard Bernstein, and to illustrate how exciting it was, she told me this story.
There's this gorgeous home that Koussevitzky lived in up on the hill at Tanglewood, and we work, before we get in front of the orchestra, we would always work with two pianos, and they would play the orchestral part. And that's where lessons would occur, you know, outside of the orchestra sessions. And so Bernstein came there and walked in the room, and of course there were, it seemed like just hundreds of people in this tiny room. And he said, you know, now, where's Maren? And I thought, I have died and gone to heaven. This just can't be happening. And as soon as I started conducting, it was the Roy Harris Third Symphony, which was a piece that they told me to learn 5 days earlier. Everything was very, very high pressure there. And as soon as he started talking to me about the piece and conducting and these kinds of things, I was completely relaxed. He was so generous and so focused on what I was doing that I almost forgot he was Leonard Bernstein. Almost.
You've said that Bernstein was unpredictable and that he could really embarrass you and that he was good at mind games. Can you give us a sense of that?
Sure. I would watch it all the time. But this was a person that was extremely, I mean, so intelligent. I mean, he was so brilliant on every single level. You know, he loved going through the Oxford English Dictionary, finding errors. I mean, when he found a mistake in the dictionary, he was in a good mood for many days. Not only the realm of his intelligence, but just the grasp of his knowledge was so far-reaching that he could make jokes that and puns that escaped every single other person in the room. So you had to be, you know, it was a little bit like the Olympics. I mean, you had to be on top form. And, of course, I think he would get a little bit bored sometimes. And it's a little bit like toying with the mouse, you know. So he would try to spice it up a little bit. And embarrassment sometimes fell into that realm. But it was never so horrifying as to be really wounding. I mean, his nature was so loving that it was never his intention, I don't think, to hurt anyone.
Leonard Bernstein was very larger than life. And I think one of the things that makes you special as a conductor is that you're so accessible and communicative. Like when I've seen you at the podium several times at the Cabrillo Music Festival in Santa Cruz. And you just kind of come out and you talk to us in the audience. You tell us about the music you're going to play. You make jokes about it. You dress, at least for that festival, very casually. And you establish this very, very kind of direct communication with the audience that is not only entertaining, but speaking for myself, it makes me hear things in the music. It allows me to hear things in the music I probably wouldn't have noticed because you've pointed it out to me before actually conducting the piece. So I'm wondering how you figured out what kind of personality to be at the podium, particularly having admired this larger-than-life figure so much.
See, I believe really deeply that having authority has nothing to do with the trappings of authority. My belief is that people know sincerity, they know knowledge, they know intelligence, and they know passion. And those are qualities that must be unwavering as a conductor. And perhaps at first they think, well, oh, how, why is this person talking to us? You know, our other conductors don't talk. Or why is this person wearing something a little bit, you know, colorful? We're not allowed to have anything colorful. Or whatever it is that seems contrary to the archetypal image of what a conductor should be. And oddly, people seem to have an archetypal image. And I think by dispensing with some of those trappings, one can cut to the essence much more quickly.
Let's hear some music. I'd like to play an excerpt of Leonard Bernstein's score for On the Waterfront, which you conduct on your recent CD of Bernstein Music. But I'd like you to kind of choose a passage from this that you find particularly interesting as the conductor, and to just talk a little bit about what's going on to make that passage so interesting.
Sure. Well, this passage from On the Waterfront is this fantastic fugue section. But unlike most fugues, this begins with a timpani playing the tune. And then he has another timpani come in, so a second set of timpani. And then he has the tom-toms come in playing the tune. I mean, not many composers would you know, have the chutzpah to have a fugue that starts melodically with the percussion. This is a fantastic unfolding. And for me, what the music is all about, disquiet and unrest, and something's not quite right. And, you know, what this idea of suspense and what's about to happen.
Oh, that's a great description. Why don't we hear the passage that you were just describing? And this is from Marin Alsop's recording of Bernstein Music, and this is the score from On the Waterfront. Music from On the Waterfront, conducted by Marin Alsop from her latest CD, her first as the principal conductor of the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Maren Alsop. In 2002, she became the principal conductor of the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. Do you feel that being a woman conductor has become less of an issue as time has gone by?
You know, the only perspective I have, of course, is this very subjective personal experience. And I have really tried my entire career from, being 18, 19 years old, never to interpret a rejection as gender-based rejection, because if I were to have done that, it would have given me an excuse for everything. And I didn't want a very pat kind of simple excuse. So I have really consciously tried not to take in those thoughts that, oh, perhaps this is because I'm a woman, or maybe they're talking to me this way and they wouldn't speak to a man that way. I mean, now that I'm at a certain stage in my career, I can sometimes see these obvious things that happen that wouldn't happen if I were a man. I mean, just the other day, it's a very small thing, but I asked who would be playing oboe in the orchestra I was guest conducting, because the person listed on my musician roster did not attend the first rehearsal. And the personnel manager, I said, well, I'd just like to know who's going to play, because I'd like them to be at the rehearsals. And then the next day, the oboist came to me and said that the personnel manager went to him and said I was really upset. I was in a tizzy, quote unquote. Now, you know, you and I know that if a man had inquired as to why the person listed was not attending the rehearsal, he would not be described as in a tizzy. You know what I'm saying, Terry?
So I know exactly what
you're
saying.
These are strange things that, and I just sort of laughed to myself that it's so obvious and so typical that it's just kind of funny. But the issue, the woman issue, I mean, it comes up obviously a lot in when I do interviews and talk to people. And I try, as someone who is now successful in this field, to really devote time to young women who are coming into the field to talk about these issues, because I think there are issues about being a woman in a field that doesn't have many women in it, still to this day, that one needs to look at if you are a young woman and thinking about going into the field.
What are some of those issues?
Well, I think they all center around perceptions and societies. I'm as guilty as the next person. That's what the strange thing is. We're just conditioned. So society's conditioning about women's roles versus men's roles. So that, for example, if you're a woman and you make a certain gesture, it's interpreted very, very differently from a man making the same gesture. And of course, conducting is all about gesture. So, you know, one of the difficult things for me in starting out in the field was to be extremely strong without appearing to be sort of overly aggressive as a woman. You know, to try to be strong and have it be only about strength, you know, to get a big sound from the brass, to get a huge dynamic range without appearing to be possessed as a woman. You know what I mean? As soon as you start trying to be that huge person, I mean, people are frightened by a woman that does that. They call her names, you know, that aren't very nice. When a man comes and expresses the same kind of gestures, he's considered very strong. So it's important as a young conductor, even further on in one's career, to really assess the gesture and try to, in some way, de-genderize it, so that gesture is about emotion and it communicates emotion rather than an association to your gender.
Do you ever wonder what would happen if you, like, walked away and had the orchestra play on its own? Like, you know, how it would sound without you there?
Yes, I mean, most of the orchestras I can talk to would probably be perfectly fine. I mean, the level of playing of the orchestras I conduct is so tremendously high. I mean, it's just world class. And what's interesting is, as you get more and more experience in front of the orchestra, the great moments in the concerts, I think, are the moments when I don't conduct very much, but I'm more sharing the experience with them than literally, you know, going wild on the podium.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes more of a shared listening, and it's more about nuance than so much gesture. And often in concerts, at particular moments that seem right for the music, I won't conduct very much at all.
Maren Alsop, her latest CD, which is devoted to music by Leonard Bernstein, is her first recording since she became principal conductor of the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. She continues to guest conduct American orchestras and to conduct the Cabrillo Music Festival in Santa Cruz. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. By Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. And from TIAA CREF, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Schindler's List, Steven Spielberg's film about the Holocaust, is now out on a special edition DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Thomas Keneally, the author of the book the film was based on. Also, we remember actress Mercedes McCambridge. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.